That's so pretty. That's violinist Regina Carter with Ntiri. It's from her 2010 album, Reverse Thread, an homage to African folk music. Yakuba Sissoko on kora, Gary Versace on accordion, Mamadou Ba on bass, and Alvesta Garnett on drums and percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, August the 6th, 2015. And 50 years ago today, after a protracted civil rights struggle that ran the gamut of intensity, from conciliation to militancy to rebellion, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act of 1965, prohibiting all states from impeding or denying African Americans the right to vote. The legislation also strengthened existing anti-discrimination laws and gave new authority to the U.S. Attorney General to prosecute offending states. Reflecting on the half century since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, it is fair to say that both the letter and intent of the law have been and continue to be violated. Moreover, the question central to the Voting Rights Act, and it's very seldom discussed in this context, but the question central to the Voting Rights Act and to several related legal cases remains unanswered. What is that question? Are African Americans citizens of the United States? President Johnson spoke boldly and eloquently about the rights of all Americans when he signed the act into law on August 6, 1965. But that central question, these many years later, still persists and still is valid to be raised. Well, let's hear President Johnson's historic speech. And it is, in fact, historic. This piece of legislation, the Voting Rights Act, considered a landmark piece of legislation with far-reaching implications these many years later. But as you will hear from President Johnson, he makes a very important effort here to give the antecedent to the act. In other words, to provide a historical context, and it is, by any definition, mind-boggling. Here's President Johnson giving his speech that day.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of Congress, members of the Cabinet, distinguished guests, my fellow Americans. Today is a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield. Yet to seize the meaning of this day, we must recall darker times. 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived at Jamestown. They did not arrive in brave ships in search of a home for freedom. They did not mingle fear and joy in expectation that in this new world anything would be possible to a man strong enough to reach for it. They came in darkness, and they came in chains. And today, we strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds. Today, the Negro story and the American story fuse and blend. And let us remember that it was not always so. The stories of our nation and of the American Negro are like two great rivers welling up from that tiny Jamestown spring. They flow through the centuries along divided channels. When pioneers subdued a continent to the need of man, they did not tame it for the Negro. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not toll for the Negro. When Andrew Jackson threw open the doors of democracy, they did not open for the Negro. It was only at Appomattox a century ago that an American victory was also a Negro victory. And the two rivers, one shining with promise, the other dark stained with oppression, began to move toward one another. Yet for almost a century, the promise of that day was not fulfilled. Today is a towering and certain mark that in this generation, that promise will be kept. In our time, the two currents will finally mingle and rush as one great stream across the uncertain and the marvelous years of the America that is yet to come. This act flows from a clear and simple wrong. Its only purpose is to right that wrong. Millions of Americans are denied the right to vote because of their color. This law will ensure them the right to vote. The wrong is one which no American in his heart can justify. The right is one which no American true to our principles can deny. In 1957, as the leader of the majority in the United States Senate, speaking in supporting legislation to guarantee to the right of all men a right to vote, I said, "This right to vote is the basic right without which all others are meaningless. It gives people as individuals, control over their own destinies." Last year, I said, until every qualified person, regardless of the color of his skin, has the right, unquestioned and unrestrained, to go in and cast his ballot in every precinct in this great land of ours, I am not going to be satisfied. Immediately after the election, I directed the Attorney General to explore as rapidly as possible the ways to ensure the right to vote. And then, last March, with the outrage of Selma still fresh, I came down to this Capitol one evening and asked the Congress and the people for swift and for sweeping action to guarantee to every man and woman the right to vote. In less than 48 hours, I sent the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to the Congress. In little more than 4 months, the Congress with overwhelming majorities, enacted one of the most monumental laws in the entire history of American freedom. The members of the Congress, the many private citizens who worked to shape and pass this bill, will share a place of honor in our history for this one act alone. There were those who said this is an old injustice and there is no need to hurry. But 95 years have passed since the 15th Amendment gave all Negroes the right to vote, and the time for waiting is gone. There were those who said smaller and more gradual measures should be tried, but they had been tried. For years and years, they had been tried and tried and tried, and they had failed and failed and failed. And the time for failure is gone. There were those who said that this is a many-sided and very complex problem. But however viewed, the denial of the right to vote is still a deadly wrong. And the time for injustice has gone. This law covers many pages, but the heart of the act is plain. Wherever, by clear and objective standards, states and counties are using regulations or laws or tests to deny the right to vote, then they will be struck down. If it is clear that state officials still intend to discriminate, then federal examiners will be sent in to register all eligible voters. When the prospect of discrimination is gone, the examiners will be immediately withdrawn. And under this act, if any county anywhere in this nation does not want federal intervention, it need only open its polling places to all of its people. This good Congress, the 89th Congress, acted swiftly in passing this act. And I intend to act with equal dispatch in enforcing this act. And tomorrow, at 1 p.m., the Attorney General has been directed to file a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the poll tax in the state of Mississippi. And this will begin the legal process, which I confidently believe will very soon prohibit any state from requiring the payment of money in order to exercise the right to vote. And also by tomorrow, the Justice Department, through publication in the Federal Register, will have officially certified the states where discrimination exists. I have, in addition, requested the Department of Justice to work all through this weekend so that on Monday morning next, they can designate many counties where past experience clearly shows that federal action is necessary and required. And by Tuesday morning, trained federal examiners will be at work registering eligible men and women in 10 to 15 counties. And on that same day, next Tuesday, additional poll tax suits will be filed in the states of Texas, Alabama, and Virginia. And I pledge you that we will not delay, or we will not hesitate, or we will not turn aside until Americans of every race and color and origin in this country have the same right as all others to share in the process of democracy. So through this act and its enforcement, an important instrument of freedom passes into the hands of millions of our citizens. But that instrument must be used. Presidents and Congresses, laws and lawsuits can open the doors to the polling places and open the doors to the wondrous rewards which await the wise use of the ballot. But only the individual Negro and all others who have been denied the right to vote can really walk through those doors and can use that right and can transform the vote into an instrument of justice and fulfillment. So let me now say to every Negro in this country, you must register. You must vote. You must learn so your choices advance your interest and the interest of our beloved nation. Your future and your children's future depend upon it, and I don't believe that you are going to let them down. This act is not only a victory for Negro leadership. This act is a great challenge to that leadership. It is a challenge which cannot be met simply by protests and demonstrations. It means that dedicated leaders must work around the clock to teach people their rights and their responsibilities and to lead them to exercise those rights and to fulfill those responsibilities and those duties to their country. And if you do this, then you will find, as others have found before you, that the vote is the most powerful instrument ever devised by man for breaking down injustice and destroying the terrible walls which imprison men because they're different from other men. Today, what is perhaps the last of the legal barriers is tumbling. And there will be many actions and many difficulties before the rights woven into law are also woven into the fabric of our nation. But the struggle for equality must now move to a different battlefield. It is nothing less than granting every American Negro his freedom to enter the mainstream of American life. Not the conformity that blurs enriching differences of culture and tradition, but rather the opportunity that gives each the chance to choose. For centuries of oppression and hatred have already taken their painful toll. It can be seen throughout our land in men without skills, in children without fathers, in families that are imprisoned in slums and in poverty. For it is not enough just to give men rights. They must be able to use those rights in their personal pursuit of happiness. The wounds and the weaknesses, the outward walls and the inward scars, which diminish achievement, are the work of American society. And we must all now help to end them. Help to end them through expanding programs already devised and through new ones to search out and forever end the special handicap of those who are black in a nation that happens to be mostly white. So it is for this purpose, to fulfill the rights that we now secure, that I have already called a White House conference to meet here in the nation's capital this fall. And so we will move step by step, often painfully, but I think with clear vision, along the path toward American freedom. It is difficult to fight for freedom, but I think I also know how difficult it can be to bend long years of habit and custom to grant it. There is no room for injustice anywhere in the American mansion. But there is always room for understanding toward those who see the old ways crumbling. And to them today, I say simply this: it must come. It is right that it should come. And when it has, you will find a burden that has been lifted from your shoulders too. It is not just a question of guilt, although there is that. It is that men cannot live with a lie and not be stained by it. The central fact of American civilization, one so hard for others to understand, is that freedom and justice and the dignity of man are not just words to us. We believe in them. Under all the growth and the tumult and abundance, we believe. And so, as long as some among us are oppressed, and we are part of that oppression, it must blunt our faith and sap the strength of our high purpose. Thus, this is a victory for the freedom of the American Negro. But it is also a victory for the freedom of the American nation. And every family across this great entire searching land will live stronger in liberty, will live more splendid in expectation, and will be prouder to be American because of the act that you have passed that I will sign today.
President Lyndon Baines Johnson, addressing America, essentially, on the occasion of signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And you certainly appreciate how boldly he spoke. And you, I mean, given the context of the times, he was very, very bold and very straightforward. But I want to refer to the math. I've talked about it on this program. At the time of making the speech in 1965, the rights of citizenship to Africans and their descendants was already 350 years in pursuit. 350 years. So that at the time that we are hearing this speech today, four centuries. This is a struggle that has been going on for 400 years in this country. That's mind-boggling, to say the least. And at the time that he made that speech in 1965, he said it was 95 years since the passage of the 15th Amendment, one of the Reconstruction Amendments. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are collectively called the Reconstruction Amendments. And these were constitutional provisions that were needed in some way to redress what President Johnson openly called oppression, oppression of people of color. The 15th Amendment basically basically guaranteeing or protecting the right to vote. The right to vote being, as he said, one of the most powerful instruments devised against injustice. Well, you see how long the country was able to live without granting this powerful instrument to Africans and African Americans. It is an extraordinary speech, but it's a speech, and like all speeches, it tends toward the ideal. He's speaking very much so about the reality of the situation at the time, which was a victory, he said. But we have to remember that historically speaking, this victory was hard won. Lives were lost. Futures just decimated. Families destroyed. People assassinated. And the cumulative effect of white supremacist thinking and policy throughout the country and what that meant to this group that was specifically targeted for perpetual second class standing in the society. But at the root of the Voting Rights Act, and we always have to make this link, it's very important. It may look like this is about voting, and it may look like this is about participating in democracy, trying to resolve this question of integrating people who had been barred from participating in the democratic process. But that really isn't the issue. At the very root of it is this question as to whether Africans and their descendants in the United States were citizens and are citizens of the United States. The question still is relevant. The question still persists. In fact, it was at the root of the seminal case here, the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision had to do with this question of whether Dred Scott, a former slave, an enslaved person, whether he actually was a citizen of this country and therefore was entitled to the protection of the law against those wanting to keep him in slavery. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that he's not a citizen of this country, nor is anyone like him, any member of his class, any member of his group, nor is anybody of African descent a citizen of this country. And in one way or the other, that particular belief, that policy that informed the U.S. Supreme Court decision is as alive today as it was then. See, that's how we have to understand this question. So technically, when we listen to President Johnson's speech, we have to be mindful that we are talking here about 400 years. This is not a question of, well, you know, this thing just cropped up and we have this problem to deal with and we've got to solve it. This has been a 400-year issue. And what does that mean? This is why we have to change our thinking. It means, it could mean one of several things. One, that the fight really was lost. On the flip side, you could say the intent prevailed. The intent to deny, the intent to impede, the intent to subjugate people on the basis of their so-called race and color in this country, which is a racist society. The President Johnson said it. This is what it is. It is not accidental that this thing, after 400 years, has not been solved, unequivocally and emphatically solved. It must mean, therefore, that the system that perpetrates this injustice is scientific in its approach, because it has yielded the result and it is continuing to yield the result it desires after all this time. That is not accidental. That is not by chance. So the question that the leadership has and that each person affected should have is to decide where on the horizontal plane of history and on the vertical axis of history, your own personal decision, as opposed to the societal decisions, where are you going to locate yourself? Are you going along with the narrative that you are free and you are, in fact, a citizen enjoying all the rights? Based on the evidence, you now have 400 years of evidence and lawsuits and articles and reports and statistics and all that kind of stuff. You have a scientific basis now to declare definitively where you are on this question, based on what is available as fact. And based on your assessment of the reality that you're living in a country that is absolutely racist in its intent and in its policies, day-to-day policies that govern life, all aspects, all critical aspects of our lives are governed by this white supremacist thinking and policymaking and law. What are you now supposed to be doing if indeed you are somehow wired into the reality that you're living? Do you continue to believe that a system means you well, that it would do the right thing? You really believe that? Well, then you have some more thinking to do. And that's what I was talking about earlier this week when I talked about the seeming disconnect of the leadership of the two oldest civil rights organizations in this country, the National Urban League and the NAACP, each of them more than 100 years old. So together we could say we have 200 years there. And we're still talking about, you know, fighting this fight that is 400 years old. Isn't it time that we get a different kind of narrative coming out of that? And people saying, listen, we have to concede at some point that this system has been extremely effective in marginalizing millions of African Americans and other people of color too. You know, it is interesting that 41 years after the Dred Scott decision, there was another case that came about. And it concerned a Chinese immigrant who raised the same question. Am I a citizen of this country, born in this country? Am I a citizen of this country, entitled to all the rights and privileges of citizenship? And the Supreme Court affirmed him. Of course, that was 41 years after Dred Scott decision. But it was nonetheless predicated on the same question. Am I a citizen? Wong King Kim Ark was the name of this gentleman. And his case was in 1898, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And he challenged this notion, predicating his argument on the argument raised in the Dred Scott case in 1857. Now, this is a society we're living in, and as lofty and as well-meaning, I would say, and again, you can't but appreciate the courage and the tenacity of President Johnson in making that speech with that tone at that time, confronting directly white America and its racist history, and pulling no punches. And look what we've got today. We've got a black president who is extremely uncomfortable about the idea of affirming the rights of people of color in this country. Embarrassed almost about it. In fact, he told people assembled there on the Mall to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 65. What did he say? He didn't tell them what he's going to do and his administration is going to do to finish the unfinished business. What he said was, the road ahead is long and hard. In other words, your 400-year struggle for equality, don't look to me to solve that. That's not my job. And don't expect me to be the miracle worker to get that done. But I am here to tell you that your problems, your road ahead is long and hard. Two different, you know, you see how life works? This is it. So I thought I would share that with you today about the Voting Rights Act. And there's much more to talk about the Voting Rights Act. And we'll try and get that done in the coming weeks because it's a very, very important subject to explore. But it is not about, again, it is not about voting, and it's not about civil rights. It's not about any of these things that we are told these issues raise. The central question has not changed. The critical question, the basis of all of this discussion still persists after more than 400 years. It has not been resolved, definitively resolved. I'm not sure it has even been in recent years. I'm not sure it has even been tackled. And would you believe that this central question coming to us in the guise of voting rights applies to every aspect of life? when we've recently been talking about the Eric Garner case and police brutality cases, when we're talking about unequal education, when we're talking about disparities in health care, when we're talking about unemployment, we're talking about the question of the rights that citizens enjoy. And all of these disparities are reflections of the truth that the people who are inordinately suffering also are people viewed by the system as non-citizens, as non-entities in the United States. They are not Americans. They are not to enjoy the full protection of the law, nor are they entitled to share on an equal basis the benefits of societies, of this society, like any other citizen. And so we see in all of these disparate ways the same question being asked. It is reflected in every major discussion that we have had. Stop and frisk. That's a question pertaining to the rights of citizens. Coming out of the Dred Scott decision, you say, well, how is it connected? Well, of course it's connected. Because you see that if you were a full citizen, you would be treated as such. Police wouldn't just roll up on you and slam you up against a wall and subject you to arrest and treat you in a manner that suggests, well, you're not quite American. That you're not quite a citizen. So we don't have to regard you, we don't have to give you the same rights and privileges, and we don't have to acknowledge that you have these same rights and privileges. That comes right out of the Dred Scott decision, and that's the central question that America has not answered and refuses to answer. That's the issue. I want us to really focus in on the tough decisions that have to be made. And I've been on this theme of getting real about our existence in this country, as a country, as a whole country, but specifically as people, not just African Americans. I just referred to Wong Kim Ark, going back to 1898, raising this question, you can't treat me this way. I'm an American. And we heard President Johnson mention that this duality, this schizophrenic life that we live as a country, has to do, as he put it, with blacks living in a nation that happens to be mostly white. You are aware, of course, there have been some changes since President Johnson's speech. I will be talking about that in great detail soon, but it is enough to say that much of what we are seeing today as oppression in all these different areas, disparities and injustices and oppression in all these different ways, has to do with the changing nature, the demographic, the shifting, fast shifting demographic changes that are occurring in this country. People are freaking out. White supremacy is having a freak out. Imagine that when the situation was lopsided and white supremacy was in good shape It was fairly intact. It had its handle on every aspect of life. And even so, it was tumultuous. Imagine what's going to happen come 2035, when, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the demographic changes in the United States will create a historic moment in this country that was never anticipated. And that is, whites will be the minority population by as early as 2035, and perhaps even earlier than that. That's just around the corner. You're seeing the preparation to rebalance the scales. And it is coming in the form of horrific powers of police. It's coming in the form of merciless attacks against social safety nets. It's coming in a harder line of demarcation about who gets to enjoy the benefits of citizenship in this country. It's already fermenting because the consciousness is there and the preparation has begun. It's a little late because it's inevitable. Roughly 11% of American counties have already shifted demographically to a predominantly Latino majority population, certainly a predominantly non-white population. More children, they even started looking at children as young as three. What are we seeing? We're seeing children, they're taking a census of three-year-olds. And they're starting to freak out. The vast majority of three-year-olds now and children being born in this time are non-white. The white population of America is dwindling. And not just America. Europe, many countries in Europe are experiencing a negative growth rate in terms of population. More people are dying than are being born. And so the attack is about immigration, just like in the United States. You attack immigration, you attack people of color. You're freaking out because your formula, which you had intended to last a lifetime in perpetuity, it's just not working anymore. And so the question of citizenship, see, this is going back to how you link all these things about people freaking out about immigration. This is what is freaking them out. You have people who are standing to reap the benefits of citizenship. They can own things. They can participate in the educational system. They can, you know, they could get bennies. And this society was never about the equitable sharing of benefits and rights of citizenship. So the law is used to make sure that that doesn't happen. And the same law that President Johnson addressed himself to, this idea of justice, and I believe he was quite sincere about wanting this change in our society. And he was quite clear in his speech, which was a very bold and eloquent speech. He talked about it in a systemic way, which means he understood this is a system. The system has to be fixed. However, it's not going to tolerate systemic change in one fell swoop. It's a gradual approach. But he stood firm and he identified the problem, except he would not say And he did not say what the basis is still here. It is the genesis of all of this tumult. It is the central fight that remains as relevant today as it ever was. Are African Americans citizens of this country? A very simple question. The evidence suggests no. The evidence suggests that the system has had remarkable success in exempting itself from the obligation that it has toward African Americans and people of color generally. Therefore, the system is scientific in its oppression. Therefore, the system cannot be looked to and cannot be trusted to do the right thing, which is why one should automatically be suspicious and puzzled and even outraged when, after 400 years, people are still talking about, well, let's work on this together and let's improve things. No. The attitude should be, we are convinced. If anything, if any doubt we had before, we have dispelled it because we understand intimately the facts of our reality. So that's my take on the Voting Rights Act. It brings us back to the question, the ongoing question, whether African Americans are citizens of this country. I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and I look forward to always getting your reactions to the programs. And let me know how they resonate with you. What are they doing for you or not? Write me at leadstories@gmail.com. I really do look forward to your notes and your opinions, your shared opinions. I want to thank you also. So many of you have been writing encouraging words and messages, and I really do appreciate it. I want you to know that I haven't been able to keep pace with the volume of good wishes coming my way, and I just want to ask you to be a little bit patient. I like to respond to everyone personally, but thank you so much for keeping me in your minds and hearts. It's really, I'm so honored and blessed by that. And I thank you very much for your generosity of spirit. It's very, very heartwarming to me and a source of strength, actually, that keeps me going. So thank you so much for that. Stay right here on PRN.FM. And while I say that, let me also ask you to promote this program and promote this station. Talk to your people. We have, I've gotten word from many listeners that they have begun, and in some cases they're continuing, because they started these groups some time ago, where within their own circles, they've established listener groups. And somehow they contact each other and they exchange ideas about what they heard on the program. And it's a wonderful thing. That is what this radio station ought to be about, and that's what it does. It connects people and encourages the exchange of information, opinions, and ideas. That is revolutionary, and that's great. That's what this is all about. So I thank you for your listening circles. It's a great thing to hear. We will join each other, of course, tomorrow. We'll be Free Your Mind Friday, and we will, from your perspective, recap the important news that we have either been discussing or that we have not yet discussed on the program. But you are in the driver's seat on Free Your Mind Friday. Thanks so much. Keep it right here. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is up next. And until tomorrow, please know that from me, that it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. Bye-bye. Thank you.